My name is Norman Baker. I was a Member of Parliament for the Lewis constituency for the Liberal Democrats between 1997 and 2015. And for the last 5 years or thereabouts of my time in Parliament, I was a minister in the coalition government, 3.5 years at the Department for Transport, covering largely public transport, and then over a year at the Home Office, where I was a crime prevention minister, dealing with all sorts of nasty things like violence against women, child sexual exploitation and animal experiments.
You've recently come out with a book about the royal finances. Can you give us its title and tell us why you decided to pick that as a topic?
Well, it's actually my second book on the royals. The first one came out in 2019 and was called "And What Do You Do?" which is, of course, what the Queen asks you when she saw you. And I thought it was about time we asked them what they did. And what do you do, what the royals don't want you to know? This latest one is more specific. It's called Royal Mint National Debt. It's interesting in this country, isn't it, that we talk about money coming in as a royal mint, but money which has to go out is a national debt for the rest of us.
What do you make of the sale of the Royal Mint and the idea that now the Chinese are taking it over as their embassy? It almost seems to be they're putting their mark in the middle of London, and they're saying, well, actually, you used to be the empire, money was at the heart of it, now we're in charge.
Well, I think there's some truth in that. I mean, I think that the it's a sign of the times that Britain has just basically mortgaged itself to the Chinese, to the Russians, to the Americans in particular. We don't really own anything anymore. It's all been sold off. It's a pretty sad state of affairs considering where we were just 50 years ago. And yeah, and the Chinese, of course, are becoming much more powerful and influential in the world. And they're attracting Western European countries because the way Trump's behaving in America, people are looking for stable alternatives. Nobody quite likes China very much in terms of their human rights and everything else, but they are stable, which America is not. But Britain is, I think it's symbolic that we've lost the Royal Mint to the Chinese. There's also an issue as to whether it's actually a sensible and safe location, given that they are very close in that location to all the cables and other information running through the City of London.
Well, there's a lot of focus on the royals after the arrest of Andrew. I noticed this article in The Independent this weekend, which references your book. It talks about the 50 residences the royal family still, even though they've apparently slimmed it down, have still got access to. A quarter of a million acres of land, and also the main thrust of the article is just the massive secrecy around how much wealth they own, what they use it for, and where it is.
Well, I mean, look, I mean, first of all, there's a chapter in my book called Houses of Windsor, which goes into all the property portfolio in great detail. They have an enormous amount of property. I mean, the houses you've identified are just those which they allegedly use themselves. You've got to remember they own whole villages, and they own probably 1/50 of the whole country, which is a huge amount for one family to own. They've even got properties Charles has in Transylvania, very close to Dracula's castle, for those interested in blood sucking. So, I mean, they've got a huge property portfolio. In terms of the finances, you've got to remember that the royal family was, the family was bankrupt effectively in 1760, and now is worth an absolute fortune. Charles alone is worth at least 1.8 billion, probably rather more than that. So you have to ask yourself, this is what my book does, how is it that a family that was bankrupt in 1760 is now so enormously wealthy? And the answer is a combination of factors. Extracting large amounts of money from the public purse, not paying for anything themselves, annexing land that should belong to state, and actually they've said it belongs to them, accepting free gifts from people, including dodgy dictators around the world, and not declaring them, keeping them themselves. You know, the whole combination of reasons why they've got to where they are. But they are, this is the Achilles heel, in my view, of the royal family. They are greedy. They are greedy beyond belief. And their whole ethos is to maximise the amount of money they can take from various sources and spend nothing themselves. They don't do anything with it, they just invest it. It just becomes a bigger and bigger chest of money. But they want to do that. That's the whole mindset they have.
Yeah, well, the 1760 you're talking about, that situation now, of course, is totally turned on its head. Although we had years of relative prosperity after the Second World War in the 60s, 70s and into the 1980s, we are now facing a serious deprivation for millions of British people, massive child poverty, whilst the royals thrive. So, have you managed to identify actually how much wealth they've got and where it's being held?
Well, we can't know that, Tony. We can know how much they're getting from the public purse. That's, I suppose, a matter of public record. We can identify a bit about what they own in terms of chattels, because some of this has been identified, in an ad hoc way over the years. What we
Well,
cannot
sorry,
really
what is a
know.
chattel?
Well, I mean, things like the Fabergé eggs, which the Queen used to have, and
Oh,
Charles has
right. The
inherited without
crown jewel,
paying.
the crown jewels. It's
Well, then the crown jewels are different. The crown jewels are held in right of the crown, which means that they are custodians of those and they don't actually own them. However, there's a whole lot of stuff they do own, private property, the Fabergé eggs, the string of racehorses, the jewellery which Charles inherited from the Queen, worth over half a billion, I didn't say million, half a billion pounds, the 100 million pound stamp collection. These are all, inverted commas, private assets, which Charles inherited without paying any inheritance tax at all. That's the other reason they're rich, of course. They don't pay taxes properly. So, they've got this huge, huge wealth they've accumulated over centuries, the last 2.5 centuries, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's got much bigger since 2011, when George Osborne, as Chancellor, stupidly changed the rules and abolished the civil list and replaced it with a sovereign grant. And just give you one statistic. In 2011, the civil list, last year the civil list was 7.9 million, which is the direct grant to the royal family from, well, to the Queen technically, from the government. This year, the replacement sovereign grant is 132.1 million. Now, that's just an obscene increase over 15 years. And you don't have to be a Republican to think that's obscene.
No, you certainly don't. Since the Queen has died, has there been any increase in the amount of money? Because I think that's another thing that, because they've got such a massive amount of wealth that they're able, of course, to get interest on, to get rent from their
Yes.
investments and accumulate wealth just from having money, they also seem to be taking more from the public purse. I find it incredible that they still need to do that.
Well, they don't need to do it, but that's a figure I've given you. That's a direct grant, 132.1 million this year for the sovereign grant, compared to 7.9 million in 2011. So they're taking much more from the public purse than they used to. And the way the Osborne changed the system means that money from the Crown Estate, which by the way, is not royal money, although it's called a crown estate. It was property given to the government in 1760 in return for a civil list. That crown estate money before 2011 would have been in its entirety gone to the treasury to fund health, education, armed forces, and the rest of the things we spend money on as a country. Now, a significant percentage of that goes to the royal family for nothing, just a kind of freebie, like pulling the handle on a fruit machine. They get it every single year where they're doing nothing. And it's got far worse because the Crown Estate owns the seabed around Britain, and Britain's got the biggest investment in the world in offshore wind. And there's now a windfall from wind farms going straight into Charles's pocket. Then there's the Duchy of Cornwall, which I believe should be publicly owned. It was declared as a government department in Victorian times. Now Charles has a quote, private estate. Although a private estate that pays no corporation tax, unusually, unlike any other
I mean,
private
the
estate.
Duchy of Cornwall is Williams, isn't it?
Well, it is now, but it was Charles before. He's got Duchy of Lancaster, Charles. Now, but the Duchy of Cornwall, you saw the brilliant Channel 4 documentary last year, which identified, with a great deal of really good investigative journalism, that the Duchy of Cornwall was charging the NHS almost £1 million a year to put ambulances in an empty warehouse in London, charging the army to practice on Dartmoor as they rehearse for King and Country, charging the navy to moor ships next to the quayside because they happen to own that quayside. I mean, and charging the scouts for their scout hut. I mean, the amount of greed which these people just exude is just unbelievable. And I think the public at large, if they really knew what went on with the royal money, would be absolutely horrified. And this all needs to stop. It needs to stop. And I hope very much that Andrew, having opened the door into interest in the royal family more generally through his behaviour now means that the attention's moving on, as it is with his podcast, onto other matters such as royal finances, where it needs to go.
Well, Rob Evans has done some fantastic work over the years opening up some of the, for example, secret letters between Prince Charles and ministers, giving them instructions and advice, a bit of arm wrenching. I mean, of course, they are royal appointed ministers, they're ministers of the crown. I wonder just how much it's journalists like him are actually able to scrutinise what the royal family get up to, because I understand it, they are treated by the Freedom of Information laws differently to government, so they're seen as almost above the law.
Well, indeed, and this is contrary to the assurance I was given in the year 2000 or 2001 by the relevant Labour minister at the time when I was in Parliament, and I asked about freedom of information relating to the royal family. I was assured, and it's in Hansard, in writing, that the royal family, as part of the public sector, will be treated exactly the same as the rest of the public sector, whether it's the government or the civil service or the NHS or an individual school or anything else. That was the assurance I was given. And since then, the royal family has striven very hard and very determinedly to exempt themselves as much as possible from the Freedom of Information Act. And you mentioned the so-called spy letters Charles was writing to ministers. Quite improperly, Charles was lobbying on policies that suited him, such as not banning hunting, for example. This is completely improper that he should have done that. And the Guardian, good for them, persevered with this and got the letters, most of them anyway, published. So Charles's reaction when he was Prince of Wales, what was his reaction? His reaction should have been to say, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that, I overstepped the mark. No, his reaction was to say to the government, I've been found out, I want to be exempted from freedom of information so I can carry on doing these things without being found out in the future. That was his reaction.
That's amazing, because it means actually what's possibly happening now is that this present Labour government, the ministers are getting these letters, but we know nothing about them.
Well, I think they probably haven't been getting them because, first of all, Charles has the opportunity as king, and in constitutionally this is probably quite proper, to have a weekly audience with the Prime Minister. So he no longer needs to write letters, and I doubt whether William is. However, the point is, if William were writing letters, he wouldn't know about it. That's a key thing. So, I mean, the Freedom of Information Act needs to be changed back to how it was intended to be. The royals should be subject to the same scrutiny as anything else in the public sector, because they are using public money for public functions.
Well, look, you're making me laugh now, Norman, because as we now know, due to a lot of Rob's work, the Crown takes a look at all laws as they come through the system, and it's allowed to just tweak them and remove clauses before it gives its royal assent if they don't like them. So it sounds to me as if that's almost guaranteed, if there are alterations to a new Freedom of Information Act, that before it gets the royal assent, Charles will strike them out.
Yes, I mean, I hate to be particularly personal about this, but I have to tell you that that was my discovery, and Rob then worked on what I discovered and made a big thing in The Guardian of it, which I don't mind. He gave me credit for it, but actually it was me that discovered all that. Look, I mean, this is outrageous. Royal assent is one thing. Royal assent is a rubber stamping exercise that nobody objects to, whereby when a law is passed by Parliament, the King or Queen as it was, gets their stamp out and stamps it, and it then becomes law. That's perfectly okay. It's a bit pointless, but it's perfectly okay. What you're talking about is the ability of the King and the Prince of Wales, who has no constitutional right whatsoever to do it, to have advance notice of laws which have been drafted by government ministers or by civil servants, and to have the opportunity to amend those before Parliament even knows the draft laws exist. That's the truth of the matter. Now, you know, they say that this is a formality, but it isn't, because you have 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks to respond to these things. And of course, what happens initially is that a phone call from the Cabinet Office to the Palace or to the St James's Palace, and to say, you know, what do you think about this? And then the discussions and the response happens orally, so there's no written record of it. So when the formal application goes to the King or Prince of Wales, of course they don't object, because by that time they got what they want. And I discovered this for the first time in 2006, when I was sitting on the Animal Welfare bill committee as a member of parliament to find out that we were looking at one of the clauses which gave the RSPCA the right to enter private property where they believe with good cause that that mistreatment of animals was occurring. Quite a sensible policy. But lo and behold, there's an exemption for royal properties, not just Buckingham Palace and so on, but private royal properties like Sandringham and Balmoral. And I thought, why are they exempted? These are private properties. Well, actually, they're not. They should belong to the state. But they were deemed to be private properties. So, you know, that's when I discovered that this outrageous behaviour was occurring. And what you see is that whatever laws come in, the palace wants itself exempted. Charles is exempted as Prince of Wales, because he was consulted as Prince of Wales, the Duchy of Cornwall, from legislation into nuclear explosions. You know, why? Was he planning to get his chemistry set out or what?
Well, it sounds to me, Norman, as if what we've got here is rather a roguish royalty that decides that when it suits it and when it's convenient, it's a public institution.
Yes.
And when it suits it and when it feels like it, it's a private institution. Of course, this obviously has enormous implications for the Constitution.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. That's exactly how they behave. They want to be private when it suits them and public when it suits them. Indeed, sometimes they're both at the same time. So they want the benefits. The Duchy of Cornwall and Duchy of Lancaster want the benefits of being public, which there are some. But they also want to then say, ha-ha, we're private estates, we're not paying corporation tax, and we're not subject to freedom of information. You know, they want to always. And this goes back to Victorian times. There's a guy called John Kirkhope, who's an extremely assiduous investigator of the Duchy of Cornwall, and he's gone back 200 years in his investigations, and he's produced evidence from Victorian times as to when they want it public and when they want it private. And it really is quite shocking. By the way, the Duchy of Cornwall, which, as I say, in my view, should be public, and gives William a kind of freebie of £25 million a year in his pocket from the profits for that, which should go to the state. What's he done since he became Prince of Wales? He has changed the makeup of the board of the Duchy of Cornwall. This is in my book. And who has he appointed to the Duchy of Cornwall to help him with his activities? Property developers and investment bankers. You can tell what his priorities are. They aren't with the people of Cornwall.
No, they certainly aren't. But what about, look, there's an argument. If we were chit-chatting with somebody from the Royal Press Office here, they would say that the benefits that the royal family bring when it comes to pageantry and tourism, really are immeasurable. And so why don't we just let them get on with it?
Well, I don't think we should base our constitution on what foreign tourists want, for one thing. I think that's really quite an absurd suggestion if the palace makes that suggestion, which it does. Secondly, you can have all the pageantry you want without the royal family. The most visited palace in Europe is the Palace of Versailles, and the French got rid of their monarchy in 1848. So, in fact, if there were no monarchy in Buckingham Palace, you get more visitors in for more of the year. So I think that argument just simply doesn't stand up. Of course, that's an argument they put. But, you know, if you want a monarchy, you can have a monarchy like the European monarchies, if you really want a monarchy. The one in Europe, the monarchies there have become part of the democratic framework, the democratic weave of the country. Kings, when they take up their thrones, have to pledge allegiance to the democratic system. Otherwise, they can't take up their throne. In this country, uniquely, we, as elected MPs, have to take an oath to them, the unelected, before we can take up our seats, even if we're elected on a platform of abolishing the monarchy. That's where we still are in this country. And, of course, those who argue that the royal family is harmless, let's just remember two things. First of all, in the late 1930s, the king was Edward VIII. Edward VIII was, at the very least, a Nazi sympathiser. He preferred to speak German rather than English. Some would actually call him a Nazi. And there's some evidence, which I put in my first book, And What Do You Do?, that he was actually passing information to the Germans. He was subject to telephone tapping by Stanley Baldwin, the Prime Minister, because nobody trusted him. The Prime Minister and the Home Secretary agreed with MI5 to telephone tap the King, because he couldn't be trusted. But he was on the throne. Now, what would have happened if he'd been on the throne when World War II broke out, and he'd said to the armed forces, who also pledge allegiance to the king, just as MPs do, I want you to lay down your arms. What would they have done? They may have laid down their arms. Secondly, let's imagine, and it's not impossible, that Charles had met a terrible accident and died before William and Harry were born. We would now have King Andrew I.
Okay. What a thought. Good God. Look, you also mentioned the Duchy of Lancaster. This is something which, I mean, I studied British Constitution O level back in the 1970s. And even then, I remember sitting there in a classroom in Kent, Bromley, scratching my head thinking, what on earth is this Duchy of Lancaster? It's supposed to be, there is no Duke. The Duke has just disappeared. And yet we do have Darren Jones MP. He's a Bristol MP for the Labour Party. He apparently represents the Duchy of Lancaster
Yes.
in the House of Commons. Well, hang on. Is this a Duke? Is it a Lord? Is it someone who's in the government? What on earth is this institution?
Well, the Duke of Lancaster is the king. And when the monarch changes, the next monarch becomes the Duke of Lancaster in turn. So that's what the position is. I mean, Charles has got numerous titles, and that's one of them. But the fact that there's a cabinet minister, or at least a government minister, who represents the Duchy of Lancaster, demonstrates beyond any doubt that the Duchy of Lancaster is a government department. And therefore, the money which comes in profits should be going to the government, not into Charles's pocket.
Amazing. Darren Jones this week has been in the House of Commons talking about saying we're very sorry, but the evidence that was given to the Prime Minister Keir Starmer, which, after which he then decided to appoint Peter Mandelson as US ambassador, we're very sorry, but there's important bits of it that we can't share. So this seems to be quite an important office. He's now saying, well, it's very embarrassing. We're going to have to cover this up for a while until the police have finished their investigations. I wonder what you make of this this decision to stop the Parliament actually seeing the evidence which Starmer based his appointment of Mandelson on.
Well, look, I mean, first of all, the Duchy of Lancaster minister, Darren Jones, has duties beyond the Duchy of Lancaster across government. So it's not exceptional that he should be talking about other things. In terms of the point you're making or question you're raising, I mean, I don't know what would come out if everything without any retraction at all were released, because it may well be that the police, as I understand it, the police are the people who've asked for it not to be released rather than the government, and the police are saying it would prejudice our inquiries. They may not want to have everything in public at the moment, or it may well be that the view would be it would prejudice a fair trial and make a trial impossible
Well,
if
hang
you
on,
got to a
because this
criminal.
information is at least supposed to be the evidence that Mandelson has sent this material is from like decades ago. I wonder why that affects things right now. I mean, surely if they're talking about this and discussing it now, it shouldn't affect it at all.
Well, I mean, what we're talking about is Mandelson committing a potentially committing, I'm sure he did, in my own head, potentially committing an offence decades ago. This is about what he did decades ago. So obviously the material relates to decades ago, because that's when he was allegedly guilty of maladministration in public office, because that's effectively the charge which has been put against Andrew, or at least that's why he's been arrested and why Mandelson's been arrested. Mandelson hasn't been arrested for being US ambassador. He's been arrested for what he allegedly did in Gordon Brown's government in 2008, 2009. So these things are. So you've got. I mean, I don't know, Tony. I haven't seen the details, but I'm prepared to accept that the police say that it might prejudice a fair trial. Then there's an argument there for listening to what they say.
Yes, well, they may have been nudged to do that in order to get Mandelson off the hook. Well, Starmer
Well,
off
I
the
think
hook.
they've gone past that point with him, actually. I think they have gone past that point. And I think it's not actually in the government's interest to withhold information. It's in the government's interest, ideally, to put everything on the table now and have a big row now, rather than having things drip, drip out over months. So I don't think it's a government, actually. I mean, I'm not going to defend the government on many things, but I don't think it's their fault that this is where they are on that.
So, how much do you think these Epstein revelations, the most recent ones, have undermined Starmer? Having made this, I mean, he made this massive gushing speech just a year ago, saying how wonderful it was to have Peter Mandelson. It's a very
Yes.
strange thing to do, to get a former Labour Party MP, a former European Commissioner, and to make them an ambassador rather than take somebody from the diplomatic service. And it's all gone horribly wrong.
Well, it's not unique to have a politician as an ambassador. particularly in America or in Australia. There's a history of using ex-politicians for that particular purpose. So that itself is not unusual. I mean, obviously, Mandelson came with form. He'd been sacked twice, including once as a consequence of my parliamentary written question on the Hinduja passport. And he'd also had questions about his claim for expenses in the European Parliament. Sorry, when the European Trade Commissioner he was. So, I mean, he came with baggage. And I certainly wouldn't have wanted to appoint him. But the view, I think, was that he brought with him some method of or some skill in handling Americans, which might not be available to a normal civil servant or diplomat. Now, I'm not saying I agree with that point, but I think there was a view that he was a good appointment for that reason. And it's also worth saying, I would have appointed him, but it's also worth saying that his appointment at the time was regarded as astute. And that's a word I think was used by people like Michael Gove and others outside the Labour Party.
Yeah,
Now, they're all saying now what a terrible appointment it was. They
that's
weren't saying
right.
that at the time.
This Hinduja passport thing, can you just tell us what happened there, especially since you were involved?
Well, that was where we had he was the minister for the Millennium Dome, and I was the Lib Dem shadow minister. I mean, I kind of created the post myself, really, but I was a Lib Dem shadow minister for the Millennium Dome, and it was great fun because the Millennium Dome was, if you remember back then, completely hopeless. They built a building without knowing which one to go in it, which is absolutely the wrong thing to do, and he had to scrabble around trying to find things to put in it, and we ended up with zones, if you remember. And one of them was the faith zone, and he couldn't find a sponsor for the faith zone. And what he did was he finally got hold of the Hinduja brothers, who offered to cough up, I think it was £1 million for the faith zone. And in return, Peter Mandelson was helping them with their applications for citizenship. Now, I found this out through various means, and I then did what I often do is ask a parliamentary question on the matter because I find it's always best to ask a question to which you know the answer. And I asked a question of Jack Straw, the Home Secretary, as to whether he'd received representations from Peter Mandelson on the applications for citizenship by the Hinduja brothers. And Jack Straw, apparently, we found out afterwards, insisted the question be answered. Now, I don't know whether Jack Straw was actually just sticking to parliamentary procedure and doing it properly, he may have been, or whether he thought he was a chance to get one over on Mandelson. Either way, the question was answered properly by Barbara Roach, his junior minister. And as a consequence of that, all hell broke loose for Mandelson. Blair sacked him the same day. So, the only example I know, Tony, of a minister being dismissed through a written question.
Well done. This is exactly what we want our parliamentarians to do. I can just say, share with something about Mandelson's reputation within the London press. When I was working there in the late 1980s, early 1990s, colleagues of mine who'd been threatened by him saying, basically, if you print that, I'll have you sacked, and him wandering around newsrooms, peering over people's shoulders as they're typing. And resting on their shoulder, his arm on their shoulder, saying quietly in their ear, "Are you sure that that's a good idea?" So he seemed to have a real interest in identifying journalists who were causing problems. He saw as he saw it. I wonder, do you think that's just a little anecdote I'm telling you there?
No, it's talk to a wider truth. I mean, I know, for example, that when I was asking, I wanted him to come to the Commons and answer questions. He was terribly powerful in the early days of the Blair government. Him and Alistair Campbell and Prescott were probably the most important people in the government. And he wouldn't answer questions. He was a minister. He wouldn't come and answer questions. So I took a policy. I made it very clear what I was doing. I asked him a huge number of written questions, hundreds of written questions, literally. And I made it plain that I would stop asking him questions when he came to Commons and start answering them orally. It finally got him there for 5 minutes a month, which is a victory of some sort, I suppose. But he hated this. He hated me for doing all this. So he spoke to Simon Walters at the Mail on Sunday, as he then was, and managed to get an article in the Mail on Sunday and a hatchet job on me, saying I was costing the taxpayer a huge amount of money with all these questions. So, I mean, it wasn't just journalists he was trying to undermine. It was MPs as well.
Yes, no wonder they call him the Prince of Darkness. So, could you just remind us of the title of your latest book, Norman, and where to find and follow you
Yes,
online?
my two books on the royal family are, the first one's And What Do You Do? What the Royal Family Don't Want You to Know. The second one is, the current one, is Royal Mint National Debt, which is particularly about royal finances. And I have to say that people who read these books start off often as monarchists and end up as republicans. And it's available from Bite Back through all good bookshops, and no doubt some bad ones as well as on Amazon.
Okay, Norman Baker, former minister, thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome, Tony.